Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. My name is Molly McLaughlin, and I own a company that optimizes sleep through technology, accountability, and behavioral change. Each week, I'll be interviewing world-class experts ranging from doctors, innovators, and thought leaders to give actionable tips and strategies that you can implement to become a more skillful sleeper. Let's jump into your dose of practical sleep training. Welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. My guest today is David Sampson, an anthropology professor. And I first stumbled upon David's work last year when researching sleep through the lens of evolutionary biology. And I had the opportunity to connect with him, and his passion for this topic is unparalleled. He truly, truly lives his brand of investigating the link between sleep, health, and cognition in human and non-human primates. So on a practical and fun level, he even gets into the weeds on how to fit all of life really into the circadian paradigm. So think where to put your alcohol, your video game usage. He's got you covered. So beyond this, he helps us understand how the stress and anxiety that are at play for so many right now have a role in our history and our sleep. So a little bit about him. David Sampson is an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Toronto. He has performed field research on wild apes in Uganda, captive apes, and small-scale human societies in Madagascar, Tanzania, and Guatemala. His main research focuses on primate behavior with a specific interest in the evolutionary of sleep and cognition in the human lineage. Let's dive in. And welcome to the Sleep as a Skill podcast. I am so grateful to have my guest David here today. David, thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me, Molly. We had a conversation several months ago and it was a blast. So I'm really looking forward to this.
Yes, me too. You know, when you have those things on your calendar and you actually are really excited to dive into them, this was one of those for me because
it's mutual. Yeah.
Yes, I love it. I literally am raising the roof with that statement. So I completely agree. My mind was just blown on our conversation that we had few months back, and you were able to really shift this conversation around sleep for me in a way that I hadn't heard other people do. So I am excited for our listeners to be able to have that similar experience with all the knowledge that you have. So I think it's good to, or could be a great place to start, just start at the beginning and a bit of your origin story around how it is that you got into this area. You know, you have lots of things to deliver for people, but particularly one of the areas of sleep, and with that, how you've brought your own unique perspective to it.
Yeah, the origin story is an interesting one, because if you were to rewind time and ask graduate school Dave whether or not he would have some type of specialization or expertise in sleep and the evolution of sleep and human cognition, say 5 or 6, 7 years later, he would have been pretty nonplussed by it. I don't think he would have understood what was going on. I started as a primatologist, and I am a primatologist. Yes. You can wear multiple hats in academia. And I did my dissertation work out at the Toro Simliki Wildlife Reserve in Uganda. And I spent nearly a year, several months out there, working on chimpanzee material culture. And what that actually entailed was really long days, sometimes 13-hour days, hiking 15 kilometers in the day to habituate the chimps, to follow the chimps, observe their behavior. But also, my dissertation question was looking at the evolution of material culture in the great apes. And what I was interested in was sleeping platforms. So what I did was I climbed these African Sinometras. They're ironwood trees, essentially. And these are preferred trees out at Simliki, where the chimpanzees will build a nightly sleeping platform. Just think of it like a canopy bed. They'll spend 5 to 8 minutes sometimes interweaving these frame-supporting branches into this beautiful nest. And I've been up there, so I've tried to make these myself, and I simply don't have the wrist strength, but I can nap in them. And I did all the time when I was out there measuring them, sometimes 20 meters above the air. So I was out there measuring finally about 72. I got an N of 72 at Simliki measuring their sleeping platforms, and then analyzed this data within an ecological context, came back to the States, and that was basically one part of my dissertation. The second part was when I went to the Indianapolis Zoo to work with Dr. Rob Shoemaker, who is the director of life sciences there. And he has worked with orangutans in captivity, well, since his entire career. So since the 80s. And I basically was interested in the ultimate causation of sleep. So what are the evolutionary reasons? What are the evolutionary functions of why we sleep, not just how we sleep and what the mechanisms are? And so our team was the first to measure orangutan sleep architecture. We used infrared videography to capture REM and non-REM in about 5 orangutans. And that was eventually published in the journal Behavior and Animal Behavior. And after that, I had ensconced myself in the literature to a certain point in which I began to realize there was this really big deficit in our understanding of sleep's role, particularly in human evolution. And once you defend your dissertation, which I did soon after the publication of those papers, defend your dissertation, you have this really weird moment where you've been focusing on this one question for sometimes several years, and you have a brief moment of respite where it's essentially, what's next? And I was really lucky because after that stint at Indiana University where I got my PhD, I landed a one-year position at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And Alyssa Katendin, who has worked at the Hadza hunter-gatherers her entire career, was my office mate. So she was right down the hall from me. And the first time I ever met her, I had already known her background and her work, which is exceptional. And I pitched her the idea of hunter-gatherer sleep. And we began the conversation that ended up me taking a total, basically 180 degree into the world of human sleep evolution and measuring sleep using actigraphy in an evolutionarily relevant context, like places like East Africa.
Wow. That's incredible. And so this has taken you all over the globe. You've had different insights on how to, channel this information, different paths to take, partnerships that you've made. And with that, I think one of the things, you know, I was taking so many notes as you were speaking, but one of the things that I would love to go a bit deeper on with you is this concept of that hunter-gatherer sleep and what it is that we in our modern day society can really learn from that. Because it's something with this concept around sleep being a skill in our modern day society is my belief that it can fit today, but that, you know, in the past, it might have a whole different world to it. So I'm just wondering if we can go deeper on that, because I know you have such insights on what that looks like. And as it relates to sleep anxiety, I remember you had a lot of really interesting information on that too.
Yeah. So the reason why sleep is interesting to study in hunter-gatherers is because in the West, we've been studying sleep for 60, 70 years, and we've gained a lot of critical information on function of different sleep architecture stages and lots of things that go on under the hood. But what we have not been able to capture are data that would allow us to test evolutionary hypotheses. Because when you sleep in the West, you are masking all the variables that would influence your natural circadian rhythm. And this is actually a really critical point. You and I are obviously indoors right now because we're talking, but everyone is indoors, and more than usual because of COVID-19.
Yes.
Everyone is spending a lot of time indoors. So we're even, you know, remove the pandemic, our culture is masked and blocked from light, natural variation and oscillations in light and temperature throughout the day. That I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with the fact that these are critical drivers to sleep-wake regulation. And so what better place to go and study sleep but in populations that have 24/7? I mean, there's no escape from their environment, which is outdoors all the time. They sleep, the Hadza specifically, sleep in acacia huts that take the women, which is, they are hunter-gatherers, so there's sexual division of labor. The women will make the huts when they prop up a new camp, and it usually takes about 4 hours to make. And so, as you can imagine, if it takes four hours, it's not that insulated from the outside environment. You do see, because you have the controlled use of fire in these societies, you do see that there is a reduction of the variation in temperature inside the hut itself, which is something that I outlined in a publication in the Journal of Human Evolution. But it's nothing like walking into a temperature regulated home right. that has a thermostat that doesn't deviate from 1 degree the entire time that you are alive living in it, you know? So this is why this is a really critical population to study sleep in, notwithstanding the fact that, of course, they're also hunting and gathering. They are gaining a living by finding all their calories in their environment. So they have a life way that is very traditional, and they have a exposure to their environment that is basically unparalleled to Western populations.
Wow. Yes. And, you know, I was fascinated when we were able to briefly, you know, discuss this a few months back. And I'm so excited to go into this a bit more for listeners, because I felt it was really interesting what you were able to point out, because so many of us might, you know, there could be the tendency to then look to that example and be like, okay, that is where you get the best sleep. This is how it should be. Mm-hmm. And you, one, pointed to that there's a whole other level, area of concern around the sleep quality that is there. So to not glorify, you know, the back to nature element a bit too much. And then the second
paleo sleep is actually not sleep most Westerners would envy.
right. Yes. I thought that was really interesting to hear more about. Yes.
Yeah.
Got that. And then so from that to understanding, because I think you are able so elegantly to paint that picture of what that looks like. And then on the opposite side of understanding the distinction between the robustness of their circadian rhythm and how there can be these different pluses and minuses where they might have that robust circadian rhythm that we don't have. They might be lacking in sleep anxiety, but then have difficulty in sleep quality.
Yeah, it might be worth just recapping what we talked about last time for the listeners that are listening to it originally on this podcast. So there's a little bit of a tension in the data that we find from these populations. And I should include the data that we generated in Madagascar. We looked at data in a small-scale agricultural population in Mandena in northeastern Madagascar. And so they too have a lot of exposure to their environment. So they're a wonderful group of people to work with on this topic. So basically there's a tension in that, yes, they are sleeping less and their sleep quality is in fact quantifiably poorer than people even in 2020. And I know that there's this huge push in the media to get everyone to think that there is some type of sleep epidemic going on. This is pre-pandemic era, right? So we'll talk about post-pandemic
sure,
sleep.
Sure.
But there's a narrative out there that gets people clicking on news stories because fear is a beautiful driver, monetary driver for people to listen to stories. So there's this idea that with cell phones and with technology, we are getting the poorest sleep we've ever gotten. And I think that this is actually false. I think that our ancestors got good sleep relative to every other primate on the planet. We can talk about the comparative perspective too. But that, in fact, we have a trade-off here where these populations that I've studied have higher circadian rhythms because they are in their environment, but poor sleep and shorter duration sleep. But the interesting caveat here is that they don't problematize their sleep. Even though they have short sleep and they have fragmented sleep and their sleep efficiency is pretty low relative to Western populations, they, when asked on surveys and survey instruments, they will respond essentially unanimously that they're perfectly happy with their sleep. So that's sort of the state of play as far as I can tell, that interesting tension between circadian rhythms and sleep and then just not really problematizing it.
You know, I love this. That point for me really stuck out because I shared with you my story and how much sleep anxiety I was going through when I wasn't getting my sleep. And so, and how many people are coming, you know, to sleep as a skill and just freaked out when their sleep is what they deem not to be great.
Let's, if you don't mind, I think that's a perfect bridge to the topic of COVID because fear is on everyone's mind, right? So everybody's experience, if we had a fear monitor, right? A thermometer that could check the population's anxiety levels, that'd be pretty cool. But if we had it, we would probably see an elevated temperature, right? Maybe not like a fever, like during a world war or something, you might see it spike to a fever level. But it's definitely up there. It's like it would, people would be like, okay, watch it. You know, if it gets any higher, go into the doctor. Yes. And what's going on here, this is a perfect opportunity for us to talk about acute fear versus chronic fear. Now, acute fear is good. Robert Sapolsky has talked about the differences between acute fear and chronic fear from an evolutionary standpoint. He's an evolutionary biologist. Yeah. Acute fear is awesome. It keeps you alive. If there's a lion stalking you in the jungle or the savannah, or there is a human threat out there, maybe a rival group that's about to take your resources, acute fear is going to upregulate your neuroendocrine system and allow you to combat that challenge in your environment. And that's going to overall increase your fitness. And fitness is the evolutionary point of the realm, so to speak, right? Fitness is what is going to allow you to survive and reproduce. So fear is good from that level. When things get tricky is when fear becomes chronic. And when that, what's called a failure of fear extinction. And we see a host of negative outcomes that can happen when that fear becomes chronic. And insomnia, I think, is a perfect example of this. And myself and some colleagues just published a paper entitled Failure of Fear Extinction and Insomnia, an Evolutionary Perspective. And it talks about this and disentangles these ideas. So what I think is going on here is that the general population has an increased fear temperature. And what is happening is it's upregulating chronic fear. Chronic fear is then interfering with the ability for people to get to sleep with ease. So it's probably increasing sleep latency and probably making the sleep more fragmented. On top of that, I'm sure you were going to probably go this direction, but there's been a really interesting narrative about the shift in dreams. Have you been keeping up on this?
Yes, I actually just did a newsletter on that one. Yeah, I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so when I heard this, and National Geographic had this beautiful expose on this topic, when I heard this, I instantly clicked it with a paper I had read several years ago from Ruvenzo and colleagues. It was a 2001 paper, and it's all about threat simulation theory. And the idea is that the evolutionary reason why we dream, one of the functions from an evolutionary standpoint of dreaming, is to rehearse threats for next day action. So a lot of this would help explain why a lot of dreams are anxiety driven. 80% of dreams on average are going to have some type of anxiety component to it. And this is at least an elegant explanation of why that might be, particularly when it comes to the social realm. A lot of people rehearse less things like lions eating them, right? And more like interactions with other people and how those would go if they went negatively.
Right.
And so this is a very common, this is statistically, they've done, Domhoff has made a career out of analyzing dreams. And this is one of the most common dream elements out there, at least in Western populations. So with this COVID-19 threat, what I think is going on here is that we're again running into a mismatch scenario. This time, though, the threat is invisible. And humans are not adapted for invisible threats.
Yes.
We're adapted for threats in our environment we can see, that we can hear. We can hear stalking us, right? And so we're simply just not evolved for invisible threats. And what we do when we are threatened is we double down on being social. We actually have the impulse, the instinct to become more social, not less social, when we're under threat. So this is like an evolutionary double whammy, right? We're getting hit on all fronts. And I think it's having an impact on the, at least the qualitative reporting of our dream content.
Wow. So this is that's such an interesting and just a nuanced perspective on this. And I think this helps really provide so much insight for people and to understand, one, what they are up against, to your point, that then this, you know, pervasive sense of now there's concerns, there's this chronic fear, and paired with the loneliness, paired with being inside. So we're kind of, you know, got some things against us, arguably. And yet with that, I thought it was really interesting how you were able to point to this concept around sleep and discipline and how it can almost become like the superpower when you're super disciplined. So I'm wondering if you could share with us how we could begin to unravel, now that we're in this situation, from your perspective, what would be some of the best ways, evolutionarily speaking, if we are kind of all inside and we got these things against us, how can we bring in that level of discipline? What are some of the things we need to do? I know you had mentioned a cultural, how did you put it? Something around cultural bank, you know, like investing in your social bank and the importance of that even for great sleep. So from that perspective, what do you see as a way for people to help navigate this and bring in some of that superpower to still ensure that they're getting rich sleep and all that?
Yeah, I think we got to double down on the basics here.
Yeah.
But also keep in mind that a lot of this stuff we can still do while social distancing. So just when I say the basics, the two pillars are light hygiene and sleep hygiene. And I'm sure that you know, your listeners are about as educated on these topics as anybody. But it's worth reiterating that sleep hygiene, you want a room that doesn't have a lot of distractions, a room that brings to you mental calmness. And you want your routine to be very, very consistent before bedtime. And so in my mind, what I tell my students is that consistency is king, because your circadian rhythm knows. And if you give it more information, it's only going to serve you better. And on that note, in terms of doing things that you can still do while you're social distancing, light hygiene, you can still go out and get a good dose of natural vitamin D. And in fact, by the way, vitamin D is one of the one reliable things that people are saying is good to supplement right now. And that has benefits in terms of your ability to fight off COVID-19. And so this is vitamin D does strengthen the immune system, particularly the respiratory tract. So this is, you know, obviously supplements are key, especially if you're in northern latitude, but getting the natural stuff is always the best. And so going out at the bare minimum, getting, you know, having lunch by yourself or with your pair bond or your family or whatever, the people you're already exposed to, and soaking in as much light as you possibly can during the midpoint of the day. And then when you're indoors, obviously, as soon as the sun goes down, turning those lights down, because that's going to help regulate melatonin. And we all know melatonin is that principal hormone that drives sleep-wake regulation. So doing that, and on the discipline side of things, meal timing is super critical. Since our last conversation, I've been doubling down on really locking in on my meal timing.
Yes.
Yeah. Awesome. And it's key. And before COVID, actually, I'd been doing a little bit of traveling, and I really found it was straight up the best hack for any type of jet lag. Because if you cue in that your meal time is always, no matter what, 3 hours before bed, right? Just whatever that time is that you're dedicating to going to the act of sleep, minus 3 hours is when you need to be eating. And then even when you switch time zones, that is an entirely different circadian pathway with which to indicate to your body that it's time to prepare for bed, despite the fact that the light is all wonky, right?
Yes.
It's been so powerful. I've been really loving that one. That was a game changer for me in terms of traveling, because I generally, even with melatonin supplements and everything, it would be days sometimes, particularly if I was traveling to Southeast Asia or something, it'd be days before I could get back to normal. So that's meal timing is critical, but it takes, believe it or not, especially if you're a family, it's going to be hard to always get mealtime at the same time. So that takes a little discipline. It's got to be something that has to be intentional. You have to build it in to your routine, just like you would your sleep hygiene routine an hour before bed. I'm a real big fan now of day gaming. So I'm a video gamer. I don't know. Did we talk about this last time?
No, I don't think so. Okay, so I'm excited about this.
Okay. Yeah, this is a totally new topic, but I'm a gamer. I mostly just to socialize with my friends online who live in different parts of North America. And I am in the same way that I'm trying to leverage my circadian rhythm for just about everything, even drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. I'm just becoming a day. If I have a vice, I just do it during the day. And the effect is like 10 times less the next day.
Amazing.
I can do, just like, you know, between you, me, and the listeners, I can be with my friends and we can day drink all day. And if I cut myself off by, I don't know, by the time the sun starts going down,
Yes.
I have no, there's no hangover. I have a completely productive day the next day. And it just takes a, like, an orientation of a reorientation and a renegotiation of when you're going to be social.
Yes.
And so, and what you do when you're social. And so I've applied that for other things too, like video games. So I'll day video game. And this is, it's way better on your system than say playing, you know, Call of Duty an hour before bed. There's just no way that your body's going to be able to down-regulate after you've been working in a group competitively. Your acetylcholine spiking, right? So you're highly motivated. Your cortisol spiking because you're stressed out. And then you turn the computer off and you think you're going to fall asleep. I don't think so, right? There's just no way. There's no way. So you just give yourself time. I only do the vice stuff before dinner. And it seems like once dinner hits, then your body's like, okay, this is your time for the circadian rhythm to lock you in to when it's time to wind down. And it's been really fantastic. So I've been leveraging that. Oh, the other one, this is another one. And I just thought of this the other day, social media intake, or even just when you click on your COVID-19 report, do it midday or do it over coffee. And as soon as noon hits, start decreasing the hits that by the time the sun goes down, just say, I'm just not going to do it anymore, right? And you'll notice that there's a circadian rhythm. It's like your body can tolerate crappy stuff better when it's totally upregulated for the day.
Yes.
And it's incompatible for that kind of stuff at night. So I've been just doing this with everything that I don't like in life. I'm like, do it when you have a peak circadian rhythm, right?
love that. Yeah. With sleep as a skill, we call it thought timing and putting that thought timing in strategically. Yeah, absolutely. And creating a whole calendar for the day, circadian crafted day that will ensure that we are, you know, dealing with it. So if they have to be dealt with, if they're, you know, big conversations or just things we don't want to deal with, but then they kind of haunt us in the evenings in bed instead, you know, tackling those during the day. I love that.
Even the big conversations thing.
Yeah.
I, you know, having a critical conversation with, say, you know, your loved one before bed is just, that's such a dumb idea.
I know.
Just cognitively pencil time to do it over lunch, right?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you're risking your entire night's sleep.
Yeah, I even got that on the flip side just a little bit ago. I was sharing this story of with my boyfriend. He gave my stuff right back to me, even from a positive stress conversation, because we do this nightly grateful thing. So we say our top three things that we're grateful for. And he was much more tired than I was at that moment. So he was like, okay, a quick grateful. He went through. One of them was Gary Vaynerchuk's video. Something that you did. And so I'm like, oh, really? What was the video about? Oh, I want to hear. And I'm, you know, clearly going to be all engaged and excited and, and then connecting, you know, for so much of my life, I had spent, been connected to stress that was what I would think of as real stress, like a negative stress. And yet to also get connected to that will actually get me fired up in an arguably positive
way.
Yeah, but it's still going to keep me up for, you know, but a period of time.
Absolutely. It's upregulating neuroendocrine systems that are designed to make you more engaged, not less, right?
Yes.
Not to downregulate. So that's a really good way of putting it.
Yeah. And I also appreciate you calling out some just real life tips around alcohol, having fun, being social, and instead of completely abstaining, how to then have a life where you have it all and just kind of reshuffle things and be powerful.
It.
Yeah.
Yeah. We can have our cake and eat it too. We just need to be really strategic about it and use the latest science to be able to maximize it. You know?
So good. Yeah. So in relation with some of the concepts you had, there's one that has stuck out with me, and I've actually mentioned it in my newsletter and, you know, given you a shout out about this because, and I continue to mention this one, which is what you've coined the candlelight challenge. And I'm wondering if you can share more about that. I thought that was brilliant.
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, I think Had I taught my first 400 level course by then, or by the time we had our last conversation,
I feel like so. you had mentioned that
like
you had
it.
You were talking like you're like not many people take me up on this is basically or like they won't continue.
So I made my
it.
Students mm-hmm. do it.
Yeah,
and they had to they were getting graded for it. Yeah,
and
I had them wear Oura rings. So I have because I have a sleep lab. I have 55 Oura rings, and
I put
all of them on my students. And we actually found the issue was compliance because, you know, I can't be there at night telling them to do things. But we did find on several different measures, there was some movement, particularly with mood and with REM. So we found that the candlelight challenge, which I will go ahead and define
sure.
right now, is 2 weeks where as soon as the sun goes down, all the lights in the house go out. And you can only use natural lighting, or if you need tech to help bolster that, because sometimes, you know, candles are expensive or they're, you know, I don't know, a hazard or something.
Right.
Go ahead and just use a portable lamp that uses the really warm tones, the warm hues, and just no blue light, right?
Yes.
So whatever you can do to eliminate blue light in your home, do. And if you have a roommate, so some students had roommates, obviously, and they wore really robust blue wave light blocking glasses, and they had a sleep hygiene routine, etc. And that's the candlelight challenge, 2 weeks of that. So if you can do that, you should, after the end of 2 weeks, there should be no way around it. There should be an enhancement of your circadian rhythm, and you should see your sleep measures move. So in a positive way. And so I think now more than ever, especially in terms of using that idea of consistency as king and discipline, this would be a great time for families to start doing this challenge. And at the very least, what you could be doing, if you have a large family or several children, you're showing them, A, that sleep is important and that routine is important. And just think of it, if you teach them good sleep hygiene and good light hygiene at that age, you could add, say, 1,000 hours of high quality sleep to their life. Now imagine that life versus a life without those 1,000 hours. And I would rather live the 1,000 hours with the high quality sleep personally, knowing how it influences my cognition, my mood, and my ability to interact with challenges in my environment.
Mm. And I'm wondering if you could kind of draw parallels real quick between the importance of that, because, you know, oftentimes when explaining why that's important, I'll kind of, you know, go back and forth, oscillate between, you know, hunter-gatherers is kind of this blueprint as far as just at least the robustness of a circadian rhythm, certainly not all the other difficulties that are up against them, but why it is that this part is so important of the post sunset and how life likely was for them, which we would assume not much extension, right? Fireplace or a fire, and that's it.
Well, gosh, Molly, when we get to the topic of circadian rhythms, that's when evolution really shows us how critical our rhythms are. And in fact, I might even argue it's definitely a more ancient trait. Mm-hmm. It's definitely the more what we call an evolutionarily conserved trait, meaning that the common ancestor going back to a very, very far date. And I'll say what that date is pretty soon. It's pretty bizarre how deep circadian rhythms go in terms of deep time. But when was the last time a common ancestor had this trait, and hence all other lineages have this trait, right? That's the idea of a conservative trait from an evolutionary standpoint.
Sure.
And so sleep has undergone lots of transitions. You look at sleep amongst mammals, amongst primates, amongst different orders, it'll find a way to move within the niche that it needs to adapt to. It's plastic in that sense, but circadian rhythms really aren't. And that's because there is just simply a fundamental advantage to all organisms, a fitness advantage to all organisms that can time appropriate behaviors in their environment. And this goes back to, we think, probably about 500 million years ago, perhaps 300 million years ago, the first eukaryotic organisms on this planet, perhaps prokaryotic, eukaryotic being multicellular organisms that had organelles, that had a perimeter around it with a cell wall. And we know this because Platyrrhenes dumarelli is one of the most ancient worms on the planet. And we share an ancestor with this worm that goes back like 500 million years. It times its its flagellum, which allows it, it's like a motor that allows it to propel upwards towards the water's surface. It times it to where when it's dark out, and so you can have flipped circadian rhythms. It could be advantageous for one organism to be active at night versus the day. That's why we have differences between animal organisms that are nocturnal versus diurnal versus cathemeral, meaning you're active at some points peaking at night and day. But this Platyrrhenius dumerilli will time it to where it's feeding at the top of the ocean when the sun is not out and there are no predators. And then it will start, when the sun comes up, it'll start sleeping and resting, and it'll float back down to be able to be hidden. And it does this with guess what hormone, Molly? What hormone might drive this regulatory system?
Oh my God, their own rhythms.
Yeah, and melatonin is the hormone. Yes. It's the same hormone, right?
That darkness hormone, sure.
Yeah, that's it. So I think that circadian rhythms has been this thing that we don't necessarily associate with sleep when people read these articles about how to improve your sleep.
Sure.
Really, I think the fundamentals are how to enhance your rhythm.
Yes.
And I think that's where we need to be looking. And sleep will come, right? If we just pay more attention to that.
Oh, it's so wise. You brought us back to the beginning.
So yes.
Preach. I love it. Amazing.
Yes.
Okay. So I mean, I could talk to you for hours. So for our listeners, I'm imagining that you've piqued their interest. So I'm curious of how they can continue to follow all your just fascinating work and, you know, what's next for you, all the projects and all the things that are coming. What's the best way for them to continue this conversation with you?
I'm pretty active on my Twitter and my Instagram. Mm-hmm. So my Instagram is Primal Primatologist, and then my Twitter account is at Primal Primate. And that's a good way. The Instagram account is me trying to engage with my students. So I've got a lot of pictures of field work and things like that out there. It's a visual medium, right? And then every once in a while, I'll post the work that comes out from my graduate students in my lab in that Twitter account as well. And of course, there's always Google. So you can just Google David Sanson, University of Toronto, anthropology, and you'll come across my academic page and my CV and all that stuff if you would like it.
Oh, amazing. Well, I got to say, I'm so grateful for you taking the time during this kind of extraordinary time and helping, one, enlighten us, and two, really help quell some of these fears for people around how to take on this topic of chronic fears and chronic anxieties and how we can powerfully navigate this and how to make meaning out of it. So I really, really appreciate that.
Well, Molly, it is always a pleasure. And I love the title of your podcast, and it's just great content and it's good stuff. So I'm really happy to be a part of a collaboration to help people sleep better.
Thank you. Yeah, you've been a part of this journey for sure. And I'm grateful to have that continue. So thank you so much.
Absolutely.
You've been listening to the Sleep is a Skill podcast, the number one podcast for people who want to take their sleep skills to the next level. Every Monday, I send out something that I call Molly's Monday Obsessions, containing everything that I'm obsessing over in the world of sleep. Head on over to sleepisaskill.com to sign up.